Welcome to Let's Talk Memoir, a podcast for memoir lovers, readers, and writers. I'm your host, Ronit Plank. Today, my guest is Joelle Tamrez. She is a memoir and life writer who's been putting thoughts to paper ever since she learned about journaling in her eighth grade English class. Before pivoting to writing full-time, she held senior roles in technology companies for over two decades and owned a yoga studio for 10 years. She earned an honors BA degree in social studies from Harvard. She is also a certified life coach and a youth mentor. She has lived in the U.S. and France and now resides in the U.K. with her husband and two dogs. The Secret Practice, 18 Years on the Dark Side of Yoga, is her debut memoir. Welcome, Joelle.
Thank you, Ronit. It's great to be on your show today.
I'm so glad that you're here, and I would love to dive in. And I know that yoga and coercive or high-control groups and gurus and swamis and India is incredibly intriguing to so many people. So can you share a little bit about what the Secret Practice is about and what was important to you to capture in your memoir?
Yeah, sure. So as you said, The Secret Practice, 18 Years on the Dark Side of Yoga, is about a long controlling relationship in the context of yoga and spirituality. I went out to Rishikesh in India when I was 22, and I met a man, Arun, and at first he was my spiritual guide or instructor, you could say, and then after a while we became romantic partners and married 2 years later when we moved to France. Mm-hmm. But what I expected to be this lifelong spiritual and very close relationship turned out to be a very controlling one. Mm-hmm. And he was controlling me emotionally first and foremost, but then also physically, socially, and financially. It really took over my whole life and lasted 18 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you were writing the memoir, did you hold in mind certain aspects of your story? Because there's a lot going on within it. There's a complex sort of, there's a power dynamic, and then there's this search for spirituality and enlightenment, and there's your youth and his age. There is the idea of being an open traveler, open to new experiences. So was there anything as you wrote or in the editing process that you were aware of needing to calibrate or to be extra careful about, or that you wanted to make sure readers understood?
Yeah, I really wanted to be able to convey what it was like to be that young and lost and emotionally vulnerable, which mm-hmm. is a situation I was in when we met. And I thought I had done that in early drafts, and then feedback said, you haven't quite convinced us. And what I realized was that once you leave a situation like that and you see it so completely differently than what you originally thought it was, it actually was hard for me to go back and essentially have that innocence again. And I had to, you know, become vulnerable and remember what it was like to be in my early 20s. So I wanted the reader to feel the story as it was happening, how it mm-hmm. felt to younger me, and not come at it with the conclusion or with an analysis. I deliberately wanted it to read in a way like a novel, up mm-hmm. to the end, so that mm-hmm. the reader will become immersed in the experience and feel what it might have been like to be in my shoes and to actually believe in this relationship.
Mm, yes. And when you began writing on the memoir, how long did it take you to get the first draft together? What kept you going when the work was hard or tough to wrap your head around and take you back to that vulnerable state that you were in when you were younger and following Arun?
You know, Ronit, when I left the situation and after we divorced, I had in mind that I would write the memoir, and that was 10 years ago. And mm-hmm. early attempts were literally a year or two later, and it was too soon. I could not really put myself back there so soon. But 5 years later, so 5 years from now, I started writing, and I joined a critique group, and I had to deliver pages every 5 or 6 weeks, and that gave me the discipline to see the first draft through. I think I was ready for it. I had had somehow my memories opened up and I was ready to start to put thoughts to paper. And the first draft took about, I would say, 3 or 4 months. And it was thin on the ground, that first draft. It was maybe 60,000 words. I knew it would need to be filled in. But that's how long it took. And then there were many drafts after that. I cannot even tell you how many. More than 10 for sure.
I know. It's like the club that we're all in, right? The club of like how many drafts, and it's just we know we're going to do it. And it's so funny because from a distance, if I weren't writing memoir myself or interviewing memoirists, I would say, why do you do this? Like, why do writers put ourselves through this? But actually, let me ask you, what compelled you to continue?
You know, once a bug bit me, I was ready. I mean, I really enjoyed the writing process. I found in it something better than what I had always thought I wanted from meditation. I got into
Interesting.
writing.
Oh, wait, I love that you just said that. Ooh, can you say that again? That's I think so important.
Yes, I found in writing, in letting the flow, you know, as you described in my bio, for me, the stream of consciousness writing, the journaling is very much how I work. I just need to let my mind go without judgment, put thoughts to paper, and I get into that flow. Nothing's quite like it. And what I said there is that I found a feeling of flow and connection and even peace, if you will, in writing that I hadn't found in meditation. All those years that I meditated every day, I found something deeper in writing. So that definitely kept me going. And you know well, Ronit, you're a writer. Some days are better than others. Some days we write for 2 hours. Some days we write for 20 minutes. Some days, so it's not that every day I'm this machine, writing words. But it's something that I welcome to start the day with. I write first thing in the morning, before anything else, takes over in my mind and other priorities come into play. And what worked for me in the beginning, being new to writing and to long form, is I did not try to edit those very early drafts. I would finish a draft, read it, and say, this isn't quite right. And I often would start again. So I think I started again maybe 3 or 4 times, and then I got into an editing phase.
So when you say you started again, do you mean you would redo the same scene or that you would go through what you had written and start working on it?
No, I started from the blank page all over.
Oh, interesting.
I always thought, you keep these. I'm sure I have all these early drafts. You think you'll go back, but wasn't right. And I just said, nope, got to get back in there. It felt more like I was a, sculptor, and my first few sculptures just, were irredeemable. So I treated it like a craft, which of course it is. And I even had, I wanted to mention one version which was a novel. And that's because the critique group I was with, they were mostly novelists, and people were in the beginning, yeah, as you've read, it's a complicated story. It has some incredible elements, has some shocking elements. So people, were thinking, what's going on here, and why don't you maybe free yourself by writing it as fiction?
And so did you do that at all?
I did a whole draft as fiction, and then I felt very self-conscious at the end. I said, I'm not a fiction writer. And I think I was hard on myself. I look back and I'm like, well, there was something fun about changing locations. Part of fictionalizing it as well was to say, look, it's quite revealing, and it reveals other people. And we may get to that later in our conversation. In my fictionalized version, the yoga school is not in Paris, but it's in New York City. I had to plant it somewhere that I know well. And there were scenes I made up, at Washington Square downtown. And I thought, why in the heck am I doing this? But looking back, I think it was fun. It wasn't, I think, as bad as I thought it was, i.e., the writing itself. But at the end, I said, no, this is my story. I want to stand by it. And when people ask me, did this happen? I want to be able to say, yes, it did.
Ah, that's so interesting because I think that some people do go for autofiction, which I think is sort of that hybrid or that idea of taking your own story and turning it into fiction or giving yourself the room and liberties you need to do whatever you can to mask the real people or to help with the stakes and the plot, right? That's so just it's, I hear in your voice and what you just said a little bit of longing for the fiction version. Do you feel like you'll ever write a version of this fully fledged as a novel?
I think it'll be too similar. I hadn't changed it that much. I mean, the arc, this particular story, because the memoir maps the relationship, it has a natural arc, doesn't it? The meeting and then the ending is kind of the arc. So I feel like it would be too similar, but you never know. Maybe as a story, I feel like right now, Ronit, I don't want to think about this
Yes,
story
exactly,
anymore.
right. Yes.
And it's out there. And also, when you say autofiction, even in the version that is my memoir, I had to respect the privacy of characters that are in there, and some are prominent. And as you know, there's another woman in there, and these people do not want to be for others to be able to recognize them. So even
Sure.
so, there is some changes I had to make to respect people's privacy, but it doesn't change the story and the role that they played in the story.
So you're married now, and I think you're married to the man that shows up later in your memoir. Is that right?
That's right, I'm married to Trevor.
Yes. And what was it like, if you can even reflect on this, if I know it's his experience, but what do you gather was his experience of watching you go through the process of writing this and the beginning of your relationship with Arun and just living through everything that happened while you are in relationship with Trevor? What was that like for him while you were reliving all this?
He was very supportive. He was very supportive of me, of the story getting written. And I think that's a huge gift that he gave me. In a way, it's a real partnership where I wanted to write the story, but he believed the story needed to be told. Looking back, I don't think I appreciated how much I put him through in the writing process until now that it's beyond it. I tell you, because you're right to highlight, Ronit. I mean, we got married in 2017 and I started writing in 2018. It's almost
Oh.
like a
I'm
so.
just laughing because there's another interview this season, and I'm not sure when they're gonna both appear, both of yours, but she too began a new relationship and moved in with someone as soon as she began writing her memoir, which covered divorce and all this stuff, and we talked about the effect on her relationship.
Yeah, it's unfair. No, it's unfair in the sense that writing is a huge relationship you're having with yourself from that point of view. But to his credit, he says it now. He says you're happiest when you're writing, reading, or speaking. So he's very, as I said, supportive of the process, but it does take up your whole mind. And there were times when you don't know why you're tired, you feel like you haven't done that much, but then writing memoir takes a lot of emotional energy as well. So yes, it's a challenge. I'm happy to have a bit of a breather from that.
I thought about your story. I've been thinking about how you were raised, which I don't know if people bring up when you do these talks or when you are asked questions about your story, but I think that you were raised with a governess and your father wasn't really there a lot, and it's not the primary part of the story, but I realized, for me at least, watching what unfolded, I thought there's very little chance you were gonna go through your young romantic life unscathed based on what you experienced as a child. And I'm wondering if there were any aspects of your story that concerned you about including. I know you mentioned the young woman who didn't really need to be part, wouldn't choose to be part of the book, but you had to kind of mask her maybe. But were there other parts of writing this story that you shied away from, or you were concerned that people wouldn't understand, or characters involved would be really upset about?
So, in the earlier iterations, I hadn't thought of mentioning as much about my family, but my beta reader said, we need to know more. We need to understand how this young woman that was me, fell for somebody like Arun. because although other young women might, it's not the most common of relationships. So they wanted more context. So I went back to the drawing board and decided to include more about my background. I didn't mind doing that. I just hadn't realized that it is so critical to give hints. I chose to not overdo the family part in the sense because I felt like there was a lot of material around the mind control, and that was that I experienced. And that's what I wanted to draw out, the mind control and what I call spiritual abuse that was taking place there. So I wanted to make sure it didn't get shadowed with too much explanation. But no, the family parts, you're absolutely right, Ronit. It was a very unusual upbringing, and there is unexplored territory there, unexplored in the writing, that I would like to put into my next book.
So. Yeah, there's so much, because I felt like what I did learn was different, so different from anything that I personally have experienced or too many of the guests who have been on the show, and so much life that you lived as a child without a nuclear family right there for you.
That's right. My sister and I, you know, we're isolated growing up, and these are things that definitely impacted, you know, what I felt and what I was looking for, and perhaps this drive for an older man that presented this ideal that I was ready to bestow upon him.
Yes. Do you want to establish a little bit about the details before you read the excerpt that we talked about and then read it?
Yes, sure. So this excerpt is from chapter 5 called Baba's Heir, and it is early on in the story. I have recently arrived in India, and I've started learning yoga, spiritual yoga from Arun. I've already paid for the first part of my lessons. Well, I think I've paid for all of it, but...
Do you want to mention how much you paid?
Yes, I had paid $3,000 to learn from him, and it was pretty much all the money that I had brought with me to India. It was the money that my dad had given me for a rainy day on these travels in India, and somehow it was the amount that Arun asked for. But manipulators are very savvy, and I must have told him. I cannot believe the amounts matched up so perfectly. Perhaps I had dropped in.
Well, I wondered if somehow he'd gotten into your room, honestly. Like, I thought, did he see what she had on her and then ask for it?
You know, these things are much more insidious than obviously I realized, and that one can realize. Anything is possible. It's possible that he got into the room. It's possible that I said things in conversation and didn't remember saying them later. So here we've gotten to know each other, and I'm learning from him. So I'll start reading. While my private lessons progressed every morning, the entourage of female tourists continued to gather around Arun, and we often met up to chat in his room in the evenings. Chantal, a middle-aged French woman with shoulder-length blonde curls, was the most outspoken and flirted openly with him. He told me privately that she had said, "Get that young girl away from you." Then he chuckled, "She thinks you're in love with me." I shook my head. No one seemed to understand how an older man teaching a younger woman could be in a pure platonic relationship. He and I were close, but not in the way Chantal imagined. Arun had as little interest in sex with me as I had with James. A few days later, when I went for my lesson at dawn, his eyes looked withdrawn. Once I was sitting down, he said, "Chantal slept here last night." I shrank back at his unexpected revelation. He looked into my eyes. Nothing happened. She wanted to, but I didn't let it. Why was he telling me this? And if he didn't want to be involved with her, why had he let her stay? We moved on to the exercises for the day, but by evening I had no interest in the usual gathering. I lay on my bed, seething with jealousy, yet appalled at myself at the same time. Arun was more than 30 years older than me. How could I even think of him outside our teacher-student relationship? James was 15 years older than me, already too old, and here I was developing feelings for a much older man. Worst of all, my spiritual instructor. I was violating the purity of our relationship and the sacred teachings. Perhaps this was the hate he had warned about, the challenge I would need to overcome before the gift of immortality. By the next morning, my mind had settled. "Why didn't you join us last night?" Arun asked when I arrived for my lesson. I was tired. I wanted to rest. He didn't say anything more but looked at me with care. Later, while I was having lunch in the reception area, I sat at a distance while he spoke with Chantal and her friend. My gaze took in his eyes. The brown irises, dull and empty, they struck me as the eyes of a dead man. Strange for a yogi. After Chantal and her friend had left the guest house to continue their travels, Arun showed me the blown-up prints of two portraits she had taken of him. In one, he was gazing at the river tenderly in profile. In the other, he looked at the camera head-on with a boyish smile, challenging life to play along. She had captured two beautiful moments, and he was proud of the photos. One evening, we sat side by side on the veranda outside his room, watching a handful of lights speckled on the further bank. A breeze rustled over the invisible river below. He sat with his knees bent, feet up on the chair, his back curved gracefully, and interrupted the quiet. "Have you ever been in love?" I thought about it for a moment. "I don't think so." "What about James?" "No, definitely not James." He pointed to his head. "You can think you're in love with someone, but that's just logic." Then he pressed the flat of his hand to his chest. "Or you can feel love in your heart. That's known as emotional pressure. But when you really fall in love, it's from here." He indicated his midriff. "Your belly won't lie to you." I hadn't felt that unmissable jolt of love, but someday it would come my way. I was sure of it. Gazing out into the darkness, he said, "People think they fall in love with the body, but it's the soul they fall in love with."
Thank you. As you've launched this book and spoken to readers, is there anything they most often ask you or that you hear a lot about your story?
You know, the surprising thing I hear about people who haven't read it yet is more than once I have heard, "I didn't know there was a dark side to yoga."
Yeah, that's so interesting. Ooh, let's talk about it. A lot of people are not aware of the dark side of yoga. And can you share a little bit about that?
Yes, I mean, it's a vast question, isn't it? But I think that in yoga and in spiritual movements, New Age spiritual movements, sometimes you hear the word neo-Hinduism, there's a lot of mind control or the desire to influence the people who are getting involved in those groups. Some of the ones that I'm more aware of are things like Kundalini yoga or Osho or things like that. But there is a dark side to the practices where it becomes something that people become dependent on and don't realize what's happening.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to discern sometimes because, well, so many times, and I think this happens a lot because if you're being asked to let go and put your defenses down, to be vulnerable, to trust a teacher, to let your body melt, etc., you are so much more vulnerable than if you weren't in that position, and people can prey on you.
Yes.
Do you feel very different from the person you were back when you were 22?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was lost. That's the best way I can describe it. And I felt like I needed knowledge and a solution outside myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I was ready for someone to tell me that they had the answer. And mm-hmm. now I'm much more careful about anyone who says that they have the answer to everything. I just don't think that's possible.
Yeah, I think you and I have that in common.
Yes. And although, you know, we still need guidance at every stage of our life, but the people who guide us should not be trying to take over our life and tell us that they are the only guide. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard that from anyone now in my life that says, "Well, you just come here, you do what I say, and that's it." I mean, I'm still a spiritual person. I'm a practicing Christian, our vicar would never say that she has all the answers and that we must only come to this church and only listen to her. Mm-hmm. And that's really important to me, that there is an openness, that we are questioning, that we know that we're humans and fallible, including the spiritual leaders, and that there is no one that has this extraordinary knowledge that is bestowed upon them, either through their heritage from the Himalayas or directly from God or self-enlightenment. You hear it all. Mm-hmm. Some of these tropes get repeated, Ronit. The ones I just listed there get used again and again and again. My teacher has the official knowledge from the Himalayas. You will hear that.
Right, right, right. And actually, you know that section that I pulled out? I don't know if you have it near you.
Yes.
Do you want to read that? It's like a paragraph and a half.
This is at the end, and it says, Arun is far from unique among the yoga gurus of our time. Take Bikram Choudhury, his old pal and creator of a trademarked hot yoga sequence. He built a global empire around his person and brand, accumulating significant wealth, while behind the scenes he led a different life and was accused of sexual abuse by multiple women. He fled from the U.S. where he faces criminal charges. Yoga did not make him good. Bikram is not alone. Gurus of the major branches of yoga have also been accused of sexual abuse, most notably Patabi Joyce, founder of the hugely influential Ashtanga Yoga, from which all subsequent flow-based yogas were created. Similar allegations have been made against senior swamis of Shivananda Ashram and Yogi Bhajan, originator of the widespread Kundalini Yoga. Arun knew all of these men and imagined perhaps that he could float above them.
Thank you. I have to say that when I was in Los Angeles before I had my daughter, and actually I did prenatal yoga at one of these places, there was this yoga studio that had a lot of followers, a lot of very, you know, white followers with money. And I went there to a couple of the sessions, but it felt like a lot more than yoga. And I just couldn't completely let go. I enjoyed the poses, but I just didn't like the dogma. And I think people really seek things like this. And I know for me, I'm very wary because of my past and I write about it in my memoir, anyone telling me what to do and how to think. But I see how it happens. I see how people want the answers. I see how people want to belong. And if you find a movement like this that makes you feel good and you're very vulnerable or young or both, you easily can get sucked up into something that you don't realize is insidious.
Yes. And you made me think of something there. For me, the way in was transcendental meditation. And I talk about that in my memoir. Mm-hmm. Because that seemed, you know, I learned TM acronym. I learned it with my mom. I was 18 years old. I'd finished high school. I'd already gotten into college. And she and I went along with my 9-year-old sister. And we just felt like we were learning something very innocuous, something that was going to be really good for us. And even we ignored some of the weirder signs that were there, even when you learn your basic training, if you will. And one of the signs that should have probably alerted us was we had to bring an offering of fruit or something and place it before the picture of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. And my mom and I couldn't resonate with that behavior, but we just thought, okay, that's a little odd. And we, you know, you don't think about it at the time and you just go on and you're given the secret mantra. And what you're being told very early on, though, is that you now have access to this exceptional knowledge. Mm-hmm. That your mantra is special for you, and that Maharishi Mahesh Yogi has bestowed this amazing gift upon the earth by sharing this knowledge. And Ronit, it is all a creation. Mm-hmm. The mantras are a creation. Sitting quietly and repeating it, that's fine. Sitting quietly with your eyes closed for 20 minutes is probably good for you. You do not need to repeat a mantra that someone made up, and you do not need to believe in the person who's teaching that, but a whole movement. I mean, at the time, it was very well known. I think it's still quite well known, and people don't think that transcendental meditation is a cult, but it really is, because it starts to plant the ideas in your mind that you now have access to something that is exceptional that other people don't have access to.
I wonder if also part of it is this idea that without this key or this wisdom or this technique, you won't be successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's part of the manipulation. What's your take on spiritual leaders? I mean, you mentioned your church, so that was sort of an answer to that. But do you think that spiritual leaders, and maybe, you know, in the church or outside of the church, in the more Eastern movements, do you think they can exist without corruption? Do you think they do?
You know, I think I want to differentiate that within, you know, established religion, be that I say Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, I'm sure there's structure. I'm not saying there can't be corruption in official religions, but there is structure. And obviously the church which is what I know more about, has had a huge reckoning around, you know, abuses in the church over the years. And there's a whole structure around raising issues, a hierarchy. And also, nowhere are you told that, you know, your priest and, you know, perhaps your rabbi or wherever, you know, or even your Hindu priest has the whole answer. Whereas what I see in your question around spiritual leaders and instructors is those self-declared spiritual leaders that have a very strong vested interest in influencing you and making sure that you are specifically following them. Now, that could take the form of, you know, these gurus that we talked about, you know, be it Bikram or Osho or all the others who have come and gone, and many are still around. Or it could take the form of, you know, the influencers online, the self-declared gurus there too. So anyone who's really creating a cult around their own personality, I don't believe that can exist without corruption, because they need your support. And it's very rarely comes with no strings attached. In fact, I would say it always comes with strings attached. There's two things you're being asked for. You're being asked for your money, and you're being asked for your belief and your time.
Yeah, devotion. Yeah. So what is your relationship to yoga now? Do you still enjoy it without the other aspects?
You know, even when I was at the yoga school and over the years with Arun, I always had in mind that as a physical practice, I never saw it as the be-all and end-all of what I would like to practice physically. So even though this part didn't make it into the memoir, because there's only so much you can put into a book, I had already learned Pilates. I had become a beginner level Pilates instructor, in part because I hurt my back in yoga when I was trying to impress Arun, and he said I wasn't flexible enough to be the wife of a yoga teacher. That is a scene in the memoir. I overstretched, hurt my back, and then when I had to rehabilitate, I couldn't do it through the same stretches. So I learned Pilates, and now I practice barre and other things. So now I think that yoga and stretching, I prefer to call it stretching and relaxing, has a place. I've done enough for a lifetime, I would say.
Yeah. You know, I hadn't planned on asking you this, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but I was wondering if you had to fill the rest of this sentence, if you had to answer this with your own answer, how would you complete this statement? Writing this memoir showed me that
I can do it.
Yeah.
Writing this memoir showed me that I can reconstruct a life experience and put it on the page and share it as a meaningful story.
Mm-hmm. And do you have advice you want to share with writers who are also working on memoirs?
Yes, I would say go for it. Don't hold yourself back or think too much in the beginning stages about who's going to read it. Is it interesting? Am I going to hurt someone by writing this? I think all these doubts might stop you from doing the full writing that you want to do. And they, believe me, they will come back. I would just say, let yourself write. Give yourself space. If you feel you need to write that story, then go for it. It's a gift you give yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also say, just beware of the early feedback that you get. If it doesn't resonate with you, if it doesn't feel like that person either understands the genre or understands what you're trying to say, believe yourself, and there will be other people who will understand your writing. I think when we are fledgling writers, that feedback can be can be either helpful or not, and we need to admit that maybe it's not helpful and move on.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Are there memoirs you'd like to recommend?
Yes, I mean, I'll recommend Ronit. There's so many that I've enjoyed over the years, but I'd like to mention the ones that helped me specifically in writing this traumatic material. It started with a Writing Hard Stories, which is not a memoir, but it's a collection of interviews of memoirists by Melanie Brooks. So that was the first time I realized there was so many people writing about their various traumatic experiences. Mm-hmm. And in that book, I discovered Sue William Silverman and mm-hmm. read Lovesick. And that particular memoir really opened my mind to the idea that you could love problematically. Mm-hmm. And even though I wouldn't have called myself a love and sex addict before reading the memoir, what she felt and what led her to the addiction and how she talked about her past resonated with me. So mm-hmm. that one was very helpful. And then in terms of just a very immersive memoir, a very famous one, of course, is Jeanette Walls' The Glass Castle. That what I appreciated in that one is that she described her childhood and didn't name a lot of the horrible things that were happening. She unpacked a very hard story, but it was almost like she was seeing it as a child without naming her parents' particular issues. So that also taught me that you could write like that. And more recently, I really enjoyed your memoir, Ronit, and you know that, and it's a beautiful childhood and family memoir. So that will inspire me now and also as I go into writing about my childhood.
Thank you. So, Joelle, where is the best place for people to find you, find your book, connect?
Yes, so they can find me on the online platforms like X and Instagram. I'm at Joelle Tamraz, and my book is on Amazon. Can also be obviously ordered into any bookshop if people prefer that. And my website is joelletamraz.com.
Great. I will put all of that in the show notes. And thank you. Thank you so much for being my guest and for helping me shine a light on the memoir process and, you know, looking closer at your story. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Ronit. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
Thank you for tuning in to Let's Talk Memoir. For more about this episode and my guest, please visit the link in the show notes or on Instagram at Ronit Plank. That's RonitPlank. You can also follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. If you liked this episode of Let's Talk Memoir, please go ahead and share it with your friends and subscribe. And if you have 2 more seconds, you can rate and review it on Apple Podcasts, which really does help other people find the show. Thank you so much for being here.